Today's guest is the author of Small Hours, winner of the 2014 T.S. Eliot Prize from Truman State University Press, and The Gravity of Falling. She earned her M.A. in creative writing from Syracuse University and her Ph.D. in feminist and postcolonial British literature from the University of Edinburgh. Her poetry has appeared in Crab Orchard Review, The Cincinnati Review, Crazy Horse, Stone Canoe, Rattle, and other journals and anthologies. She has published numerous reviews and essays about contemporary American and Scottish poetry, both in the U.S. and abroad. She teaches at Valencia College and lives in Orlando with her husband, the poet and memoirist, Brian Turner. Welcome to Poets Cafe with poet Elise Kuznets.
Match Girls. In the factories of America during the 19th century, girls hired to make matches would dip the match ends into a chemical vat, then lick the tips to make them stiff. Phosphorus vapor filled the air, a poison about which no one warned them. So when their teeth fell out and their jaws rotted like bad fruit, it was too late. It was not the first time such things happened. Bent at their workstations, women in the 18th century cured ladies' hats with mercury, their legacy, blushing, aching limbs, a plague of rashes, parchment-thin pages of sloughed skin, curled and cracked, minds deranged. They could not know they shared a fate with Emperor Qin Shi Huang, who, seeking eternal life, swallowed pills laced with mercury. He built the Great Wall and unified China, then outlawed all religions not sanctioned by the state, burned treatises on history, politics, and art. Scholars who dared possess such things, he buried alive. His body lies in a vast mausoleum, guarded by a terracotta army. Of the factory girls, mouths opening below earth, their bodies burning like forbidden books, we know almost nothing.
Thank you, and welcome to our show. I'm so glad you could make it here, talking to you all the way in Orlando, Florida. This poem and a number of your poems deal with a terrible injustice in the world. And I wonder what the inception of Match Girls was, what inspired you to write this particular piece?
Well, it's a sort of income inequality at a staggering rate, and also the rich get richer and think that they're doing the right thing for them, and the poor become poorer and think they're doing the right thing for them, and they get the same result.
That's right.
They die in the end.
I don't know if you're familiar with the poet Julie C.
No.
He worked at Foxconn, you know, which is the company that makes iPhones in China. And he committed suicide at the age of 24. It's another kind of echo of Match Girls in its way, you know, makes me think of the people in their own alienation, you know, and the hardship. And they're in this grinding assembly line. Anyway, so he wrote some fantastic poems speaking out about the injustice, and I just think what your poem speaks to, and really the collection, some of the collection speaks to, and also in your new work, highlights the social injustices going on.
Yes. That's very important to me, too. When I see an injustice, I have to say something, you know? Otherwise, I myself am not. I'm passing it by. I'm refusing to bear witness.
That's right. That's right. And that's one of the elemental powers of poetry, I think, of the poems of witness.
Yes, very much so.
Would you read another poem of witness, Harbinger? Anything you want to say about that before, or you can just read it.
It's very much about bearing witness and really just seeing a lot and not being able to see very much.
Right.
Harbinger. Just another day in hyper-capitalist society. In my Facebook feed, news of rabbits and chickens tortured on meat farms, but I'm still not vegan, and I'm waiting to die myself from cancer I may have gotten from soil or groundwater contaminated by nuclear weapons, and no amount of posting uplifting stories is going to fix that. And Lord, let them cease trying to control women's bodies, people's genders, people's desires. Let them stop hating people because of their color and ethnicities. I want to shake the bigots and racists till their teeth rattle loose and they lose their bite, till their tongues swell up in their mouths and they're stricken mute. I want to save all the slaughtered animals, save the seas and their inhabitants, whales, birds, the tiniest bivalves, from choking on plastic. I want to purify the air of sulfur and carbon dioxide, scrape the lead from plumbing pipes. God, I need to do something besides dying, besides thinking about death. And the neo-fascist politicians who lead a nation of people unable to think critically after 40 years' systematic dismantling of the education system by the rich, so their lackeys can make it illegal to prosecute corporations for poisoning the air, earth, water, and Jesus, isn't it a kind of mental illness, annihilating what you need to stay alive for the accumulation of blind profit, and in the process killing and killing and murdering me, along with the people and animals I can't save but want to with all my goddamn fucking heart. But instead, I'm waiting to die, trying to find some last meaning in all of this. A warning, perhaps. You're next.
So powerful. Thank you so much for that poem. That's that is a life changer for anybody who reads it and can feel the power of poetry to create an awareness of what's going on in our world, and hopefully to motivate people, you know, for change. You'd posted on your page about a mycologist who'd figured out how to use nature to keep insects from destroying crops.
Yeah, I think it's quite extraordinary.
So. Right, because a lot of these guys or persons that come along and they've figured out a way to handle a situation, you know, without causing damage, as this mycologist has done. It's a big blow to Monsanto. He has insects that can stop the crop destruction.
It's amazing what science has turned out to be able to do, but it's also disappointing because the government really won't let them innovate and try things out, even in a small space.
It's very true. Your next poem, we're moving into completely different waters here on how to build the Stradivarius.
Yeah, this poem is very different. This is sort of about creating something that is really delicate and is about the song, singing, and a kind of sonic resonance. I don't know if it's a poem of resistance so much as it is a poem about a kind of mathematical exact sense, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I suppose it's about being so concise and so reflective of the mathematical aspect of the process of building something. That one is much like the other.
A lot of your poems deal with, I mean, either, as mentioned, you know, poems of witness, also history and persons, significant persons in history, and but also science.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a fast science geek.
Great.
Yeah, that's what the new book is very much about, finding someone that you think that you may have lost because you've died and you can't find them again.
Oh my God, that hits home with me. I just lost one of my best friends, so yeah, I want to read that book.
Yeah, so this person who's the narrator ends up looking pretty much everywhere and sort of tries the theories that are out there, you know, from the past or the future determining the present.
Mm-hmm.
The, you know, parallel universes.
Right.
You know, just wherever she's sort of heard about people being, she tries to find this person.
What is the name of the new book going to be?
Oh, it's called Angel Bones.
Angel Bones.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Would you like me to read How to Build a Stradivarius?
Yes, please.
How to Build a Stradivarius. The masters wrote, to yield the best results, harvest after a cold winter, the wood condensed by ice and storms in whose gales the highest notes are born. From summits of Balkan maple, red spruce gathered in a valley off the Italian Dolomites. They carved each instrument's alluvial curves. Then came the varnish. One coat of painter's oil, another of plain resin, only the thinnest of layers to obtain that satin chatoyancy that liminal reflects. It said Stradivari, playing to the trees, first noticed the straight pines like strings on a vast divine violin, absorbing heaven's vibration. The truth could be found in the song itself, how it was impossible to tell where the wood ceased and the song began, notes pure as a mathematical equation, transposing mountain, valley, mountain again.
Thank you. If you're just tuning in, this is host Lois P. Jones on KPFK's Poets Cafe with our special guest, Elise Kuznets. How it was impossible to tell where the wood ceased and the song began. It's just phenomenal line of transformation and metaphysical in its essence to me. I don't know if you ever saw this. A photographer took a series of photographs of the inside of the Berlin Philharmonic's instruments. Did you ever see that?
No.
I'm going to have to share it with you because it'll just blow your mind. And your poem really makes me think of that because you see these S-shaped clefts of light and they come in and it's like you're inside the cello. And the,
oh, wow.
Oh, and it's all teak, this teak room, and it's like a holy, holy place, you know. And you've communicated that so well in your poem.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you, because I understand that you started writing at 16.
Oh, yeah.
and what point did you feel your work began to really develop? Because you'd mentioned in this earlier interview, you said, well, that work was quite immature. But when did it develop, and what were some of the things that brought that development about?
Well, I was always maybe an angry teenager. You know, we took back the night a lot. So I would say as soon as I started writing, I was, you know, kind of an activist, and, you know, I remember one poem where I had a poem about Dorothy and the other characters in The Wizard of Oz.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Dorothy was, you know, kind of pissed off because she wasn't getting her due. And these bricks kept falling on her. So I would say, yes, that was the start of it. But
And were there particular persons or influences that helped you to develop this incredible body now that just stands as both lyrical and narrative?
You know, I'd like to just listen now to the voice that guides me. And my style has changed quite a lot in this next book. It's lyrical, but it's got a narrative part of it is more very straightforward and lyrical. I would say if you were to look at my last book and this book, it may be much more sort of straightforward, but it has a lyricism that even if there are just straightforward declarative sentences, there's a very kind of set out lyricism, maybe.
Let's take a look at another one, Scientists Decide, Past Events. What's a great example of that?
Scientists Decide, Past Events, Determine the Future One's a Lullaby. Comes from the idea that scientists have recently decided that the past events are actually determined by future ones. I had no idea. So, apparently, you have future events, and these are the ones that decide the past events. You can't help it. It washes down on a wave.
Well, let's hope the future events are more promising than the present events.
Yes, let's hope. So, scientists decide past events determined by future ones, a lullaby. So it all comes out in the wash, apparently. All the karmic twists, the moments to which we'll bear witness in the future, whether we touched in love and our eyes connected us. Remember that the future controls the past. So I watched you. I surrounded you with watches, though time is an illusion, and this is a sea of timelessness. Though time simply measures a span of energy temporarily animated through the presence of mass. And let me say it again, we control the past by viewing it from the future. We entangle the past, our total consumption of a particular moment in the past, and this and not that happened because I cared, we cared, the past born from a star somewhere when this quantum moment became a particle and not an uncertain, swirling wave. Maybe it's about perspective. A blue and purple striped balloon floats further away. We are dots on the field. No, it's more than that. It's about adoration. I'll always be watching you go. You'll always be headed toward me. That's paradox. But your heart stretches to accommodate the thought as if infinity were simple science, and we, two pioneers of it, natural philosophers of the quantum brain, shining into the star stream, knowing the arrow goes where it wants. We joke about it in that future garden where we sit under a gazebo in spring and watch the cardinals get sniffy, the jays indignant, as Buddha or goddess washes the imaginary stream of time calmly over us, and we clutch each small paradisal instant to relive it, marvel over it, tachyons and all.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. It's actually quite marvelous, you know, because, of course, when we connect with the future, there's a sanity within that. Mm-hmm. and a way to determine what will happen.
Yeah. This is host Lois P. Jones with our special guest Elise Kuznets on KPFK's Poets Cafe.
Okay, this is really off the wall, but I was listening to this video yesterday about a woman who was talking about these different kinds of, like, there's your primary soulmate, and then there's your companion soulmate, and there was about 12 of them, you know. And I just thought, how interesting that is, you know, these people, whether we believe it or not, and I know that's taking what you're saying in a different direction, but we do have these deep connections, and we do want to make them again, I think, in some future place.
I thought that search kind of overtook me, and I love the idea of searching, you know?
Mm-hmm. So. Absolutely.
Speaking of searching, there's a poem you wrote for Brian we'd love to hear.
This is a love poem to Brian, because I write those too. Alright, love poem. I will be the invisible full moon filling your crescent of Gianuzzi, the gondola gliding through your canal of Gougier. I will be the protractor that figures your angle of Ludwig, the compass arm drawn to your areas of Kohnheim. I will climb your periods of Malpighi, drink from your cistern of Peque. I will stroke your philtrum and fill your antrum of Highmore with sweet scent. I will love each trapped column and convolution of your body, your 70,000 miles of blood vessels which end to end would form a rope encircling the earth, your heart that beats 100,000 times a day, then moors, restive oared, each night to me.
That's beautiful. Thank you.
That's the science and the love poem.
Right.
They diverge together.
And what an extraordinary life to have found one another, two great poets.
Yeah, I feel very lucky. You know, Brian and I share a lot of our poetry, and we share a lot of, is this the right word? What do you think about this? You know, so we help each other, and I think that's rare.
I think it is rare, and I think it's also very interesting that there's sort of a counterpoint, because you speak of war through history, and he speaks of war through experience, and yet they're both anti-war in their way.
Yes, mm-hmm. Very much so.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that's a really clever way of looking at it, actually, because I do avoid it in a certain way, and he does avoid it in a certain way. And the two of us together, though, seem to be able to talk about it in a way that we need to talk about it.
So we're running out of time now, and how about if we go out with holding Albert Einstein's hand?
Sure. Yeah, this is actually a very different poem. This poem happened after I knew that I had cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And it was much more disjointed than the poems before it. So it's very lyrical in a very different sort of way. So.
Oh, it's gorgeously lyrical. This is the poem that appears for our listeners. It's the last poem in the book of Small Hours, which I encourage everyone to get.
So this is called Holding Albert Einstein's Hand. The corpse tree full of wasps, their razoring wings, outside my hospital window, in twos and threes returning. And so it goes, and so it goes. A woman knows what a woman knows. Words for losing places. Hiraeth, Sodad, Morinia, Dor. The four chaise lounges of the apocalypse, wait for us on the sands, knowing time is a rope, a deck of cards, an empty glass. This place to sit by the ocean, watch sanderlings run from the waves, the long-fingered light of late afternoon. Fear of disintegration hollows out my bones. I am becoming bird. A sparrow flew into the house, could not find its way out. How it knocked pinioned fist against the ceiling. Years ago, my heart was trapped like that. And how the starlight traveled toward me, though I was already dead. Radiation to the marrow, pharmacon swirling in my veins. Everything dies. Driving toward Venus, I want to hear what the sweet executioner says. My bones like burning matchsticks. Sometimes when I wake, I'm shaping the world with my hands. Sometimes when I sleep, the world shapes me. Once I was energy, hiding inside the light or the shadow of light. Love rooted us together, exponential. After, we spoke in tongues. Our fingers cupped the universe like water.
Thank you so much for being with us. This is host Lois P. Jones, and our guest has been Elise Kuznets with her gorgeous book, Small Hours. Many thanks to our producer, Marlena. Look for us on the Poets Cafe fan page on Facebook. You've been listening to Poets Cafe on Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond.